Welcome to Solder Smoke, a podcast about homebrew electronics and amateur radio. This is a program for people who like to melt solder and build their own rigs. For other episodes of the program, go to www.soldersmoke.com. For the latest Solder Smoke news, go to soldersmoke.blogspot.com. Please send feedback to n2cqr@yahoo.com. So, as we step away from our soldering irons and oscilloscopes, please join us for another edition of Solder Smoke.
And I'm hanging, this has nothing to do with building a heat kit either, might add. I'm working from scratch. So I'm hanging over this cadmium-plated chassis. The bottom was up. And I'm carefully soldering this, I believe it was a 2,500 ohm resistor into the cathode circuit of this 6SJ7GT. The bottom of the socket, seeing them carefully, and I've got this iron hot, and I've heated up the lug, and that smell, that exciting, heady, erotic, almost a sexual smell of burning rosin, which is a smell that all soldering iron men know. You know that exciting smell of rosin burning? That means things are happening, and you're working on and this little thin thread of blue smoke as the rosin burns, and boy, that 2,500 ohm resistor goes in there beautiful. I snip it off with my alligator, you know, that.
Oh man, that's it. That's Gene Shepherd talking about solder smoke. I just had to open with that. I mean, the name of the show is Solder Smoke, and very rarely do we get somebody as prestigious as Gene Shepherd, K2ORS, talking about the smoke itself. And that is a special message out there for Steve Snort Rosin out there in California. I know that he'd been waiting to hear that clip. And thanks to Jonathan KB1KIX for sending that to us. That's from the 30th of July, 1975. Gene Shepherd speaking on WOR Radio New York, that powerful, powerful station with the 50-kilowatt smile. I guess 50 megawatt smile. What am I saying? Clear Channel AM. Anyway, Shepherd talking about soldering. We've got some more Shepherd clips that have been sent in, and I'll try to get them up on the blog. I know some of you guys are becoming Gene Shepherd fans. Oddly enough, our British listeners seem to be particularly taken with Shep, maybe because he wasn't really well known in the UK. But in spite of his extreme kind of New York attitude, it can be off-putting. I say this as a New Yorker. Shep seems to be developing quite a following in the British Isles. So great. All right, back to Solder Smoke. It's Solder Smoke 112. For those of you who are keeping count, this is the 26th of July, 2009. We're a week late. We missed Solder Smoke last Sunday. I put a note about this up on the blog. We were on the road. Vacation time is upon us, and we were back in Sicily for an additional week and a half on that wonderful island. We were down there in April and liked it so much that we went back again. And this time we went to many of the same places that we went before. My mom is with us, and so she went on the second tour of Sicily with us. This time we went down to the southwest part of the island, in the area around Agrigento, where they have one of the best preserved ancient Greek collection of ancient Greek temples in the world. It rivals the temples in Greece itself. And it's on a really beautiful, fantastic site just above the sea, on a hilltop near the town that's currently known as Agrigento. In ancient times, it was Akagras. And just amazingly beautiful red sandstone temples preserved from 2,500 years ago. Really great stuff. Sicily is... it's beautiful any time of the year. It's kind of dry in the summertime. It's warm, but it's not that much hotter than Rome. Rome is quite warm right now. I'm sitting here in the air-conditioned shack with the fan going, trying to keep the the temperature reasonable. But anyway, the Sicily trip was the reason for the delay in Solder Smoke 112. While we were there, of course, a big anniversary took place, the Apollo 11 moon landing 40 years ago. And I put a note about this up on the blog. It was a big event for me. I was 10 years old and totally into the space program. I wanted to be an astronaut. This was before I realized that myopia would prevent me from being a fighter pilot, which for a long time was kind of a prerequisite. But anyway, at the time, I was just totally into it. And I followed that Apollo 11 mission minute by minute. You know, there were a lot of guys who put notes about their memories of Apollo 11 up on the web. For me, I don't really remember very clearly. I remember watching on TV the first footsteps on the moon, but for me, the clearest memory is the landing when they landed the LEM on the lunar surface. That I remember most clearly because it was about about 4:30 in the afternoon on the East Coast in the United States, and on July 20th, 1969. And I can remember going out to my back porch and telling my mom and my siblings who were out in the backyard that men had landed on the moon. And, of course, I imagine I stayed up late. I'm sure I did. I can remember, but not quite as vividly, watching the first footsteps. For me, the big deal, I guess, was the landing, which I really think, I mean, I know all the attention was placed on the first footstep. But really, I think the big achievement is landing. And, of course, Neil Armstrong's harrowing final approach over the Boulder field there. Just great stuff, exciting stuff. I noted in the blog that there's an Italian angle to all this that doesn't get a whole lot of attention. And I want to give it a little bit more attention here. The command module pilot, Michael Collins, was born in Rome. And his dad was assigned to the U.S. Embassy here, which is where I work, and I've always wanted to get a little bit more information about the Michael Collins connection with the Eternal City. So maybe I'll dig into that and get some more info on it. Apollo 11's anniversary also brought a lot of media attention. You know, Neil Armstrong, he's not really a kind of a media guy, and his appearances are quite rare. He's a very private individual. Also, I think Neil is reluctant to talk about his emotions or his experiences. He's much more of a technical guy. The second guy to set foot in the moon, Buzz Aldrin, is much more active in the public sphere, and he was on TV quite a bit for the 40th anniversary, and I really enjoyed listening to his commentary about what it was like to land on the moon. I recalled a passage in the book Moon Dust by Andrew Smith, a British book, really good book. I've talked about it here on Solder Smoke. But there was an incident when the author was trying to interview Buzz Aldrin. He showed up at the apartment, and apparently, well, Buzz had kind of very difficult encounter with some of the paparazzi-style journalists, one of whom was apparently a moon landing denier. And he apparently got up in, as we'd say in the States, he got up in Buzz Aldrin's face. And even though Buzz was in his 70s at the time, it turned out to be a big mistake for the journalist. And man, I thought Buzz handled it just perfectly. And somebody posted a video clip of what happened on the blog site. So if you're looking for more details, just go to the soldersmoke.blogspot.com, and you'll find in the comments section on the Apollo 11 article a video clip of exactly how Buzz Aldrin handled the media in this particular incident. All right, talking about vacation times. Yes, vacation times are upon us, and while I was in Sicily, I had my BlackBerry with me. so I could read QRPL and the Knights, the mailing list for the Knights of the QRSS. And I read a couple of articles there and some messages about Hans Sommer's trip to Grenada. Hans went to Grenada for vacation, but the most notable part of his trip was the preparation. He got up at 3 o'clock in the morning on the day that they were going to depart from the UK for Grenada, and with only 2 hours available to do this project, he whipped up on his workbench a low power QRSS beacon transmitter, completely homebrewed from start to finish in the 2 hours that he had available prior to departure. Man, that is a homebrew hero achievement. He got it together. I think he got it out at about 100 milliwatts, threw it in the suitcase and flew to Grenada, fired the thing up there, and was promptly spotted by grabbers all around the world. So congratulations to Hans Sommer's, another really impressive achievement in a long line of impressive achievements from Hans, and particularly apropos of this vacation season. My own vacation plans, like I said, well, we've been doing quite a bit of traveling. We were out on the island of Ponza and then the Sicily trip. Rome is a wonderful place, but it's not a great place for kids during the summer. So we've made arrangements to have a summer place about an hour north of Rome in the Sabine Hills in Sabina. And I'm going to take with me out there and set up my HW8. It's going to be solar powered. We're going to have an end fed long wire. And I'm going to try to do some solar-powered portable operations from the northern hills of Sabina. It should be fun. I'm also going to take the telescope with me, which I don't get to do much astronomy from here in central Rome, but the skies are a lot clearer out there in the hills, and so we'll have the scope with us. Let's see, what else can we point to here? Some progress on the regens. I've been talking bad about regens. And I went so far as to say that I believe that you've heard me say this several times, so I won't dwell on it. That regens have some connection to the the nether regions, and that they're possessed. And I got some feedbacks. People were saying that I was being too harsh in my commentary on regens. But I have to say that most of the people who wrote in on this point, to a certain extent, agreed with me. Some of them would not go as far as saying that regens are from the HE double hockey sticks area, as they would say on The Simpsons, as Ned would say. But those who said that it was unfair to say that the regens were from hell actually said, well, they're not from hell, but they're possessed. One guy wrote in and put a comment on the blog that, well, they're not really possessed, but each one of them is different and unique and has to be handled in its own special way. Okay, yeah, I agree. But anyway, I decided not to give up on my one FET regen, and so I went to work on it and have achieved quite a bit of improvement in dealing with some of the problems. The receiver is now working fairly well. The transmitter is, I believe, transmitting. So somewhere during the course of the summer, or perhaps in the fall when people come back from vacation, I will attempt to make the desired one contact with the one FET transceiver, at which point it will be placed on the shelf in the N2CQR M0HBR CU2JL Radio Museum, and hopefully never operate it again. Now, somebody wrote in and said that there's an entire branch of the hobby devoted to this kind of rig. It's called 1AD. 1AD. AD standing for active device. One active device. So I'm thinking that this might be some sort of self-help group or kind of maybe, you know, an AA. Instead of AA, it's AD. They may have a 12-step program. I'll check it out and let you guys know what I find. As I was working on this thing, I was thinking about knack-related radio maladies, the kind of things that that we suffer from when working on rigs like this, and other radio gear, and some of the thoughts that came to mind, some of the afflictions that we suffer with here. You know, I've talked about my beloved Drake 2B, probably far more than many of you would like, but you know, you get some problems with the Drake 2B that you don't get with other more modern rigs. And of course here I'm talking about the dreaded illness, dial parallax. You know, you could just see Dr. Kildare, the guy walking in with the stethoscope in the white coat and saying, I'm sorry, ma'am, but your son Dilbert is suffering from dial parallax. Those of you who've had the Drake 2B know what I'm talking about. Those of you who are more in the glowing numerals world don't. And what I'm talking about here is the Drake 2B, you get one frequency readout as you look at the receiver directly, but then if you move your head just a few inches to the left or right, there's a gap between the little dial and the numbers written on the piece of glass, and you get a different frequency readout, and this, my friends, is dial parallax. Now, with the one FET transceiver, you can't get dial parallax because, well, there's no dial. But there's something else, and this was the illness or malady that I was dealing with before I departed for Sicily, and that is another kind of problem that you get when you're working on these rigs. It's the dreaded hand capacitance. Yes, hand capacitance. This means that every time you try to tune this thing, the mere act of placing your hand near the control knob without moving the control knob changes the frequency of the entire device. So I had to deal with hand capacitance, and I used the top of a pen, a plastic top of a pen. I connected that to one of the knobs, and to the other. I couldn't find the top of a pen, but sitting here in the shack was a wooden clothespin that I quickly adapted, and now that's the second knob to the second capacitor used to attempt to control the frequency of the one FET transceiver. You can get pictures of these two devices in action on the soldersmoke.blogspot.com page. Check it out. Other illnesses that come to mind, of course, we have parasitic oscillations. We have your thermal drift, you know, and then there's the heartbreak of psoriasis. Nope, that one goes too far. No, anyway. Some of the things we have to deal with in the fascinating world of scratch-built homebrew. All right, let's see what else we have here. Oh, I mentioned taking the scope out to the country. I'm looking forward to that because this has been a big month for Jupiter observations. From here in central Rome, about the only thing I can really observe in any meaningful way is Jupiter. I understand Saturn right now has receded and is now in the glow of the sun, so we can't take a look at Saturn anymore. Saturn wasn't very exciting recently either because the rings were kind of edge-on and you didn't get that real big ring view that you would get when the rings are kind of to the side. But Jupiter's there, and I've been looking at Jupiter on and off over the last few months. But on July 19th, there was a big, big discovery, a big event on Jupiter. And an amateur astronomer in Australia, his name is Anthony Wesley, and was observing Jupiter with a 14-inch Newtonian reflector, a homebrew 14-inch Newtonian reflector. I'd like to mention. I think that homebrew bit hasn't received enough attention. But using his homebrew scope, Anthony Wesley, an amateur astronomer, noticed something different about Jupiter. He noticed a scar on Jupiter and quickly realized that he was looking at an impact scar. A very large comet had hit Jupiter shortly before Anthony's observation and left a scar the size of the Earth well, there's no surface of Jupiter, but in the Jupiter gas field, I guess, in the clouds of Jupiter. Anyway, he saw it there. This all reminded me of my observations of the impact of the Shoemaker-Levy 9 comet, or train of comets, that hit Jupiter in 1994. I was in the Dominican Republic. I had my 4-inch Tasco reflector telescope, and from the front yard of my house out there in Santo Domingo was able not to observe the actual impact, but the results of it. And I could see with that little 4-inch scope a little smudge mark that marked the impact spot of the Shoemaker-Levy 9 comet. Anyway, I've got a picture of the most recent impact up on the blog, and a link to Anthony Wesley's webpage on which he describes the discovery. And I really got a kick out of this. You read through his description of how he made this important discovery. A discovery, by the way, that was so important that when NASA heard about it, they reprogrammed the observing schedule for the Hubble Space Telescope, and they aimed the Hubble at Jupiter to take a look at this event. You know, in astronomy, you don't get to see changes too often on on anything. I mean, you could watch the moons of Jupiter go around Jupiter, and they leave shadows, and they go behind the planet. So it's kind of exciting in that regard. But actual changes on the surface don't come along too often. Anyway, other than kind of slow movement of the great red spot, the GRS. But this was an important event, and I think you'll enjoy reading Anthony Wesley's description. You know, there's a lot of parallels between amateur astronomy and amateur radio. They're both technical hobbies, and many of us are involved in both of these hobbies. I think when you guys read Anthony's description of his gear, his work, his observations, his interest, you'll realize that well, these guys don't actually have the knack. They're definitely kindred spirits. So check it out. I think you'll enjoy it. I wanted to, you know, when I read about this, I realized that a description of my observations of the Shoemaker-Levy 9 impact are, in fact, in the book Solder Smoke: A Global Adventure in Radio Electronics. The subtitle is "With Occasional Forays into Astronomy, Kite Aerial Photography, and Model Rocketry." I thought today I'd give you another little excerpt from the book. As I've said, the book is a technical memoir. In other words, I tell my story about my own experiences with ham radio, starting from my days as a teenage radio builder in suburban New York. My mom is here with us now, and I took the opportunity during her visit to sit down with her and read to her some of the portions of the book that describe the tales of an electromagnetic youth, my early days as a radio amateur, because she was right there for all of it, and had to listen to my efforts to teach myself Morse code. But the book also contains kind of technical subchapters, and what I do is I describe my struggles to understand radio theory, and I present whatever understanding I've come to, and sort of provide some what I hope will be useful hints to those who are sort of involved in a similar struggle to understand this stuff. You know, Gene Shepard probably was the one who gave me the idea that a true radio amateur, to be among the truly anointed, among the inner group of true hams, you had to really understand this stuff. And if you were working on theory that you didn't really understand, or if you were dealing with circuitry that you didn't have a deep understanding of, well, you were in danger, my friend, of being considered by Shep and Bolus and his friends to be kind of an appliance operator. And of course, none of us want that. So anyway, that for that reason, I present these technical interludes. And let me just read you portions of one. This is the first one, and it's called Understanding Electrons and Electricity. It opens with a poem, and Michael, AA1TJ, will appreciate the poetry here. All things by immortal power, near or far, hiddenly to each other linked are, that thou canst not stir a flower without troubling of a star. And that's from The Mistress of Vision by the English poet Francis Thompson, 1857-1907, as quoted in the article Why Antennas Radiate by Stuart G. Downs of the January-February 2005 issue of QEX. Like most kids who play with batteries and wire, I wondered what it was that made those buzzers buzz and light bulbs light. Consultations with adults and library books provided some superficial explanations. I was told that it was electricity that did the job. Perhaps I even learned that small objects called electrons were pulled from atoms and made to run through the wires. But I was left wanting to know more. Later, when I was studying to become a radio amateur, I felt an obligation to know more, to really understand what an electron was and how it managed to run through the wires. I didn't realize it at the time, but in seeking deep levels of understanding, I was setting some unreasonably ambitious goals and setting myself up for a collision with some of the fundamental mysteries of the universe. Richard Feynman won the Nobel Prize for his development of the theory of quantum electrodynamics, the scientific explanation of how electrons interact. Here's what he says about trying to really understand these things. Quote, I think it's safe to say that no one understands quantum electrodynamics. Do not keep asking yourself if you can avoid it, but how can it be like that? Because you will go down the drain into a blind alley from which no one has escaped. Nobody knows how it can be like that. Close quotes. Isaac Asimov put it this way, quote, exactly what electric charge is, we cannot say. However, we can say how a substance with electric charge acts and how we may measure the extent of this action and therefore the size of the electric charge. This is an operational definition of electric charge that is enough to satisfy scientists, at least for the time being. In 1989, a British engineer named F.A. Wilson published a wonderful book entitled From Atoms to Amperes. It is filled with the kind of wisdom and advice that I could have used during my days as a teenage radio fiend. The book was published by Bernard Barbini of London and is unfortunately out of print. It is so good that I think we should launch a campaign aimed at getting the publisher to bring it back. My copy is now held together appropriately by duct tape, crazy glue, and rubber bands. The yellow pages are scarred with my underlines, circled phrases, and exclamation points, all marking the many eureka moments that F.A. Wilson provided. The opening chapter of the book is entitled Avoiding the Deep End and begins with this very useful caution. Quote, we are not physicists whose mission in life is to dig deeply into the mysteries of the universe, but people wishing to know something about what makes electricity tick. It is well, therefore, to decide first how deeply we wish to get involved. That's a bit of wisdom I wish I had, that I wish had been included in some of the books that I was studying as a kid. Those books were often quite smug and left me with the impression that it was possible to completely understand at a deep level the nature of the electron. I felt that somehow I was just missing something. It wasn't until years later when I came across Feynman's honest and humble admissions and Wilson's good advice that I was able to accept the fact that there are limits to our understanding and certainly limits to my understanding in these areas. So, in an effort to stay out of Feynman's blind alleys and Wilson's deep end, I decided not to torture myself trying to understand what the electron is made of or where its electric charge comes from. I essentially went back to the very simple model of the electron that they teach you in school, little bits of charged matter swirling somehow around the nucleus. As Wilson put it, quote, the work of the battery is to separate the electrons from their atoms and direct the differently charged particles to the appropriate terminals. As for the wire, When a metal allows electrons to flow through it easily, it is said to have high conductivity. This is due to it having a copious supply of free electrons available, free in the sense that they are not permanently attached to atoms, but free to move around. After a while, I was no longer beating myself up about my incomplete understanding of the electron. I learned to live with it. I told myself that the true wizards of the radio art would not look down on me for this gap in my understanding. After all, I reasoned, carpenters aren't expected to understand the molecular interaction of nail and wood. Cooks aren't expected to understand the chemistry underlying their sauces and souffles. And so I shouldn't have to really understand the electrons that move through our circuits. But still, it kind of bothered me. All right. Anyway, that's what that sort of sets the tone for the technical portions of the book. I read another excerpt and put a video up, and if you go to the Blogspot page, you'll find the links to the videos, and on my YouTube video page, there's an excerpt from another portion of the book that you might like. Anyway, I'm really pleased that the book is being well received. Guys are writing in. Everybody seems to be enjoying it and finding it useful. And if you're interested in it, you could very easily find a link to the Lulu vendor who is handling the distribution and mailing. It's available around the world. Lulu has printing plants up in the United States and in Europe, so it's relatively easy to get. You get it pretty fast. And just go to the soldersmoke.blogspot.com page, and up in the upper right, you'll find the link to Lulu. All right, let's see. And that brings us to...
Time for...
Sorry, smoke mailbag.
Hello.
Indeed.
Yeah, 3 weeks, so we get a lot of mail. I'll try to get through it quickly here. I don't want to run into double overtime. Dave, M0OBW, writes about... the possibility of having some sort of solder smoke interaction at the upcoming RSGB convention in October. I told Dave it's a little early to make any commitments, but I'll give it a shot. I'd definitely love to go back to the UK, love to go to the convention, and we'll see if we can make it happen. Bob Locher, the author of the Complete DXer, was kind enough to send me a copy of his book. Really wonderful stuff. I've been reading it, really enjoying it. I have it with me out in Sabina. And it's Bob has a really wonderful writing style, and I strongly recommend The Complete DXer by Bob Locher, L-O-C-H-E-R, a well-known DXer and honor roll guy, and he really nails it in terms of the capturing the excitement of going after the DX. Thanks very much for that again, Bob. Jeff, V-E-3-I-C-H, wrote in and said he enjoyed the Solder Smoke book. He noted that he started in ham radio as a teenager with a Heathkit HR-10B and a DX-60, and I'm delighted to report that he says that solder smoke has inspired him back into the world of homebrew. Thanks for letting us know about that, Jeff. Thad, AJ-8T, wrote in and provided us with somewhat disturbing views of guys who are so into crystal sets and homebrewing that they've actually had schematic diagrams tattooed onto their arms. I'm not a big fan of tattoos, guys, but I must say that the one with the very simple crystal set I found somehow appealing. So thanks for sending that along, Thad. Bill, G4KKI, is going to the beach. He's taking with him Solder Smoke, the book, and the book Thunderstruck. He's going to Poldhu in the UK, which was one of Marconi's most important sites. He's going to be on the air from Poldhu on August 6th on or around 14060, the QRP frequency. Thanks for that, Bill. Kai, OH6EH. Kai writes in and just casually mentions his job, and I have to say he's got the cool radio job of the week. Kai is a radio astronomer. He was listening to Solder Smoke 111, and he thought he heard me playing some sort of Slow Hell transmission in the background. I wish I was. I wasn't. So I don't know what that noise was. I listened to it on my on my machine here and didn't hear it. So it might be an artifact resulting from a different bit of software used to play the that particular episode, or it might be a sound card thing. I don't know. But Kai, you weren't the only one who wrote in. There was some apparently some strange beeping going on with in Solder Smoke 111. Don't know what it is, but it wasn't slow hell. So this remains something of a mystery. If anybody can figure this out, please let me know. Jeff, KO7M, our friend with the Piper Cub, writes in, and he kind of curses me a bit for getting him interested in telescopes. He's out taking a look at telescopes, and he finds himself the victim of another related knack-related malady. He doesn't even, I don't think he even has a scope yet, but he's already fallen victim to aperture envy. Yes, aperture envy is when you have a telescope with a certain aperture and you find yourself thinking, geez, I wish I had a mirror that's just a bit bigger. And it's there. You got to control it. I think I've kind of maxed out at the 6-inch Dobsonian level, at least for the time being. Any bigger, I wouldn't be able to get the thing in the elevator. So, anyway, good luck with the aperture envy there, Jeff, and let us know what happens. Steve Snort Rosin, I know this is a big Solder Smoke episode for you. What with the Gene Shepard quote on the erotic nature of rosin, of melting rosin. But Steve provides some good technical point this week. We last episode we talked about the use of spark plugs as lightning arresters. Steve, I think, correctly points out that a one mega ohm resistor to ground would probably do a lot better, because not only would it help channel the big jolt that comes down the antenna wire, but it would also help bleed off the charge even before the lightning bolt strikes. So. Yeah, thanks for that, Steve. Mads, LA1, TPA, writes in and agrees that most of life's problems can be solved with either WD-40 or duct tape. And he notes that if it moves and it shouldn't, use duct tape. If it should move and doesn't, use WD-40. Thanks for that, Mads. Dion, K6WH, also known as ZS1ACB, writes to us from the marina in San Diego. Man, talk about a cool QTH. He's experimenting with vertical antennas using telescoping fishing poles as supports. He's also playing around with the software-defined radio and soft rock. And I put a link to some of his experiments up on the Blogspot page. Really interesting, very cool stuff. We got an email that really made me chuckle here. It's from Jack, AI4SV, who was until last month, Oscar November 9, Charlie Sierra Victor. Jack and his family are in the same kind of line of work that I am, and until very recently were assigned to Belgium. And Jack reports that he picked up a copy of the Solder Smoke book and was reading it 10,300 meters over Greenland while en route back to the United States. And he said he enjoyed the book. And when it arrived, it created a bit of tension in his household. He said that the book arrived while he was at work, and he immediately got a text message from his wife asking, "Who is this Lulu person, and why is she sending you packages, Jack?" All right. Yeah, Lulu. Yeah. I hope this isn't causing any matrimonial difficulties out there. Perhaps you guys should explain that Lulu is just the printer. It's not an actual woman. And I, by the way, I'm told that the word Lulu, and I think Lulu was set up by the same guy who brought us Red Hat. But Lulu it derives from the old American expression, sort of like "it's a Lulu" or "she's a Lulu," which means kind of a good one or a good thing. There you go. Steve G0FUW he's reading. Well, he read the book, and he actually followed my advice to take it on vacation with him and took it to Kenya. So Jack was reading at 10,300 meters over Greenland, and around the same time, Steve, G0FUW, was reading it in Kenya. Very good. Kevin, ZL3KE, the fellow who helped me revive my old Toshiba Satellite Pro computer, notes sent in a report on World Moon Bounce Day. And I noted on the blog that, you know, if you have your calendar, if you have World Moon Bounce Day noted, well, you probably have the knack. Yeah, Kevin notes that there's now efforts afoot. They may have already been done. I think I even reported that some of the German hams actually succeeded in not EME, but EVE, Earth, Venus, Earth, bouncing signals off of Venus. I just find this all really, really cool. Some people have noted that this is sort of like the ultimate ham radio technical achievement. I hope one day to participate, but I'm not in the best situation for these kind of antennas, guys, but one of these days, and I really enjoy hearing about other people's adventures in this area. Let's see what else we have here. Martin, NV3V, also known as LU1CBL, writes in asking about the Handyman's Guide, NR5A's article, The Handyman's Guide. We mentioned this a few weeks back. Paul wrote a really excellent article. Paul, NR5A, wrote a really excellent article called The Handyman's Guide to Homebrew Transmitters. And he and Tony Fishpool and I have been going back and forth talking about it. And Paul has dug up the original articles and the original files. And we're in the process of getting it ready for prime time. And it's been a real pleasure working with Paul on it and just discussing some of the technical features of the article. So hopefully Martin will have that ready in one form or another for publication, perhaps as a GQRP online publication. We'll see. Bob, N1BE, sends in more Shep clips, more clips from Gene Shepard, and I'll try to get them up on the blog page soon. I know you guys really like to listen to Shep, especially his ham radio programs. And Bob also notes that he's involved in amateur radio direction finding, ARDF, and it involves going through a five-mile course in 3 hours and finding the hidden transmitters. I did a bit of this in with the radio club in the Dominican Republic, and they called it pigeon hunting in Spanish. And they would put the transmitter out there somewhere in the city of Santo Domingo, and then the club members would go out with some really, I mean, outrageously outfitted jeeps and cars with all kinds of directional antennas up on top. I think they had the transmitter going on 2 meters, and it was great fun. So this has always been a really interesting sport, the amateur radio direction finding. Bob N1BE is into it. Tuck, AF6GQ, writes in and very kindly says that he's finished reading Empire of the Air, the book that we've been talking about, and is ready to pass his copy on to anyone who would like to pick it up just for the cost of sending it via media mail. It should be very inexpensive. Get in touch with Tuck. His email is Tuck, T-U-C-K, at Cruzio. That's Charlie Radio United Zulu India Oscar .com. Tuck at Cruzio.com. Let him know if you're interested in getting his copy of Empire of the Air. Very kind of you, Tuck. Thanks for sending that along. Greg, Oscar Hotel 2, Foxtrot, Foxtrot Yankee, our man in Finland, is going on vacation in early August to, drum roll please, the Azores, to Punta Delgada on São Miguel Island, my old stomping grounds. Greg, we got to talk. I can give you some pointers. It's a great place, really interesting. I think you're going to enjoy it. But, man, I am definitely the guy you need to talk to. I spent 3 years out there. I know it pretty well. We'll have to exchange email here and talk about your trip. Bill K2RXQ writes in about a project to build your own Apollo landing computer. And check that out. I'll try to get some of the links up onto the blog. And then finally, the final bit of mail I thought was really interesting comes from David, KB1BED. And it's about Mount Rainier, about the cesium clocks, the three kids up there. He comments on all this. He says, but the real reason I'm writing is because of the Weekender column in the July issue of CQ Magazine entitled The Joy of Kit Building by W9NMT. Part of the second paragraph goes like this, quote, home brewers are MacGyver-type people who can take an oatmeal box, a razor blade, and a set of old box springs from an old mattress into a room and come out a few hours later with a full kilowatt transceiver that fits in a shoebox. Let's see. It says, such abilities are far beyond my skill set, and to me at least, homebrewing involves secret incantations, crushed bat wings, and the eye of a newt, all on page 61. David thought that the solder smoke world would really get a kick out of that. We do indeed. Thanks very much. Some of us are kind of, I guess, halfway between that. And I find myself closer to the incantations, crushed bat wings, and the eyes of the newt. Thanks very much, David. Thanks for sending that in. Guys, that brings us to the end of this week's Solder Smoke episode. Hope the summer's going well for you. Hope to be able to get another edition of this out here probably in mid-August. Have a great summer. Be safe. Safe driving, safe swimming, and all that. Watch out for the sunburn, and hope to talk to you again real soon. Keep those emails coming in. 73 from Rome.